Hi and welcome everyone. I'm Stacey Barr, the Performance Measure Specialist of StaceyBarr.com, creator of Pump and the Performance Measure Blueprint, and your host for the Measures and More Mastermind. This is our October 2009 expert interview webcast, and it's with Stephen McDaniel on the topic of a week in the life of an analyst rockstar, using analytics to dramatically boost bottom lines. And I will introduce Stephen more formally in just a few moments. Now, as you all know, the Measures and More Mastermind is an online international network for performance measurement practitioners so that we can connect and learn with and from each other. So whether you're new to Measures and More or whether you've been with us for a while now, congratulations for investing this time to develop your professionalism and your expertise to meaningfully measure what matters. You'll know my personal passion is to, I guess, kind of hold the space for us to do this together, for us to become a community of practice, and that's what the Measures and More Mastermind is all about. Every month, we hear direct from the world's thought leaders in business performance management and from our fellow performance measurement practitioners as real-life case studies. And also, I share details from my personal experience with you on how to measure things that you're struggling with, and also practical strategies for how to engage your colleagues to measure what matters. The whole idea is to inspire you, to save your time, and to help you leverage what you learn, not only from your own experiences, but from those of your peers as well. So again, congratulations for being part of our exclusive, unique, and very rapidly growing community. Now, I do have just a few announcements for you before we get underway today. By now, just about all of you will know about our upcoming Performance Measure Blueprint workshops for the rest of 2009. We're in Melbourne for October 28 and 29. We're in Sydney for December 2nd and 3rd. And now I can finally confirm for you that our workshop in the USA is in Las Vegas on November 10 and 11. Now, our Melbourne workshop, October 28 and 29, is at the lovely Marriott Hotel, where we always hold our Blueprint workshops now. It's such a wonderful venue there. Our Las Vegas workshop on November 10 and 11 is at the Platinum Hotel, which is one of the favorite off-strip venues, away from the crazy crowds, but not too far away if you've always wanted to see what the Las Vegas nightlife is like, or maybe take in a show while you're there. And lastly, our Sydney workshop on December 2nd and 3rd is at the beautiful Sydney Marriott Hotel. Now, we only run one workshop per year in each city, so don't wait another year, another whole year before you come along. This blueprint is the only way to get the detailed practical techniques and the templates too for measuring what matters. And the sooner we all start measuring what matters, the sooner we'll all start achieving what matters. Now, one final reminder for you, as a Measures and More member, I'm offering you a 20% discount to attend these workshops, which is a rare thing because it's usually only our gold members that get the 20% saving. So whether you're a silver or gold Measures and More member, don't miss out. You can read all about the benefits of the workshop, pick up a few freebie tips as well, and what we cover in the workshop at a special URL I'm going to give you now, because that's the only URL where you can get the 20% off. And that's StaceyBarr.com/PMBWCustomers.html. So StaceyBarr.com/PMBWCustomers.html, where PMBW is just the acronym for Performance Measure Blueprint Workshop. Gold members, your next Measures and More event is next week, and it's our Show Me the Measures webcast. And the topic is measures that matter for websites, how to track your website's value without tracking hits. And we're going to rethink the old hat purpose of a website as an online brochure and define measures of a website's value that align with its true call to action for visitors. And the call to action really is what marks a website's true value for any business or organization. And our mastermind coordinator, Claire, she'll email you the details for that Show Me the Measures webcast. Now, our very next event for all of our Measures and More members, silver and gold included, is our October case study webcast. And I'm going to be your case study this time around. And our topic for this will be something that's really quite close to my heart and very topical these days, as we're seeing the role of corporate performance officer becoming more and more prominent and anybody with performance measurement skills and experience is becoming more and more in demand. In fact, it was probably only 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was chatting with one of my clients, and she was saying that she just couldn't find anybody to fill a new performance measurement position that they'd created. So I know these, the demand for the kinds of skills that we have is growing quite rapidly. So that's our October case study. It's the topic of carving out a KPI career, the skills, lessons, and inspirations that made me a performance measure specialist. This case study webcast, which is freely available to both Gold and Silver members, is on Tuesday, October 20, 9 a.m. Brisbane time, and that's Monday, October 19, 7 p.m. US Eastern. And look out for more information about these upcoming events. Claire will be sending out an email to you. She'll let you know all about it. But right now, let's get started with today's topic. The idea of analytics is to focus you on exactly where and how to make those significant shifts in your business or organizational performance that you really just can't get by just looking at your performance measures as they track through time, or by just sort of walking around and seeing or listening to what people are saying. Analytics is a very, very powerful tool for really revealing those insights that we can't get any other way. And if people could see how dramatic its impact has been for others, I reckon many more managers would stop wasting time with trivial tokenistic measurement and start truly analyzing their data, digging down, looking for patterns, looking for insights, looking for clues for what's really going to leverage business success. So in our webcast today, Stephen McDaniel is going to arm us with undeniably convincing examples of the dramatic bottom line impact of analytics. In fact, today's expert interview could almost be a case study interview as well, so you're getting a double whammy here. Stephen's going to share a range of tantalizing examples of how analytics can dramatically impact your bottom line by revealing insights that are very actionable, that we can take action on. Not just the, that's interesting, but the, wow, that's useful. We're going to cover how a niche winery analyzed its customer segmentation using the customer lifetime value metric and dramatically increased its marketing ROI, or return on investment. We're going to look at an oil and gas reserves case study that demonstrates the emerging value and impact of using analytics and powerful metrics visualization in journalism. Now, don't worry if you've got nothing to do with journalism. This is just a fantastic additional example of how you can draw amazing insights out of data, particularly data that's been around for ages, but gives you this fresh look at the insights. We're also going to look at how analytics reveals strategies for maximizing the uptake in a community of green practices, the kinds of things we want the community to do to be more environmentally friendly and sustainable. And I'm hoping that we'll also have time today for Stephen to give us a review of Tableau software, which is very, very powerful for analytics and building dashboards. And I've been playing around with it myself for the last few weeks and have fallen in love with it, quite frankly. Now, we also have a download for you, a presentation to give you a visual dimension to our webcast today. So if you haven't already, you can open or download this from our webcast page. It's under the blue heading that reads Download the Presentation PDF. And you just click on the file there that's called Freakalytics and Stacey Barr Day in the Life Analyst Rockstar.pdf. Stephen, I think you deserve an award for the longest file name ever with that one.
Yes, I'm very descriptive in my file names. I have so many files on my computer.
I know what you mean, though. I'm so glad we moved away from those days when we only had 8 characters to name a file back in the late 80s, early 90s.
The cryptic meaning where you needed a key, yeah.
yeah, crazy. So, everybody, when you click on the link to that file, it will open in a new window so that you don't lose your connection to the webcast page. So go ahead and do that now so that you're ready to follow along with us. And I'm going to go ahead and now formally introduce you to Stephen McDaniel. Stephen has had 20 years of experience as a teacher, a consultant, a leader, an innovator, and even an author in the fields of business intelligence, data warehousing, and data mining. And he is founder of Freakalytics LLC, great company with a great website. There's a link there on the webcast page for you to check that out too. He's got a really couple of cool blogs there. He's also author of Rapid Graphs with Tableau Software and SAS for Dummies. Stephen is dedicated to helping people understand, present, and take action with their data. He's also worked, or at least been invited, as an instructor at over 50 leading organizations, including the biggies like Netflix and eBay, the US Department of State, Yahoo, Target, and even Boeing. And I was lucky enough to meet Stephen through a mutual friend and colleague, Stephen Few, who many of you already know is one of the world's leading experts in information dashboard design and visual quantitative analysis. Stephen McDaniel and I have already had a chat in preparing for today's interview, and I think we got on like a house on fire, wouldn't you say, Stephen?
Yes, it was really enjoyable, and I really love your work, and it's interesting how they fit together so well with analytics and the whole metrics measurement and thinking about business differently.
Absolutely. It's great. We could have talked for hours. I could have anyway. Stephen was also the inspiration, everyone, for my new love affair with Tableau software, which, I, like I said, I've been using over the past few weeks to build a sassy dashboard for my own business KPIs. So, Stephen, a big welcome. And is there anything else you'd like to add for our listeners to get to know you a little bit?
Well, and as you said, I have an unusual background of statistics and data mining and data warehousing, and I've also worked in business intelligence, and I just saw how I keep seeing there's still a gap between, I'll call it advanced analytics, and what I'll call metrics and financial management, operational management of firms. And I see that gap beginning to close due to people like Stephen Few and some of their books that help popularize analytics, and I think also just Google and Netflix and the Netflix Prize, at least here in the U.S., has raised awareness of advanced analytics and its potential. And unfortunately, I think someone like yourself and Stephen Few and hopefully myself, we're going to hopefully help close that divide and make people realize that there's a continuum. And business intelligence, I think, was the first step toward that continuum. And products like data mining products and forecasting products have sort of a nice intermediate step, which in my mind is Tableau. I think it's the first visual software I personally had seen that really did something besides make a graph. It really lends itself to, I'll call it a visual narrative or statistical narrative. So that's my background. It's very unusual, and that usually is a good thing. Occasionally it's a bad thing, but I'm very excited to be here and give you some examples of cases that are somewhere in the middle of that continuum.
That's awesome, Stephen. I'm really excited to have you too, because I think I've, to a large extent, lost touch with my roots as a statistician, which I really only spent about 3 or 4 years of my career being when I left university. And I've always still had that passion for how we can get much, much more out of our data. But going into the business world, I was finding a lot of people just weren't comfortable with data and doing really basic statistical methods that were at a very fundamental level. So I spent most of my time sort of going back and working with people at that basic level. So I'm very excited to talk to you today and to start, you know, reigniting that passion for just how powerfully we can analyze our data. And everybody, I want you to know, to use software like Tableau to do some of the things that Stephen's going to show you today, you don't need a 4 or 5 year degree in mathematics and statistics. You really don't need that. The tools today do so much of it for you with just some basic awareness of statistical thinking. You can do some very powerful stuff that, well, for a lot of companies has just completely transformed them. So, Stephen, I reckon we just jump straight into this and let's look at your first case study that we'll talk about. And what I would like reminding myself as much as reminding you, Stephen, is as we go through the visual PDF that we've given to people, if we can keep track of page numbers so that we all know that we're literally on the same page.
Certainly.
So our first, the first case study is about this niche winery and about how you helped them analyze their customer segmentation and using a very, very well-known customer KPI or customer metric called customer lifetime value, which unfortunately, not a lot of people in Australia are using this measure yet, but I know it's used quite extensively overseas, but a very powerful measure. And by using that segmentation, you were able to help this niche winery to really dramatically increase its marketing return on investment, or, you know, how much it was getting for its marketing spend. So take us through that case study, Stephen, please.
Certainly. So on page 2 of the presentation, this is a direct-to-consumer business winery primarily. And in the U.S., that's fairly common in some of these destinations like California, Oregon, Washington. And it's an interesting business because usually you think of a winery and they sell a lot to distributors. But this winery, like I said, has a significant amount of sales and almost all their profit tied up in the consumer business. An interesting thing happened with this winery where they got a lot of press in the last year or two, and it changed the nature of their consumer business simultaneously with the downturn in the economy we saw late last year. And that made them very concerned about what is the impact on marketing and the ability to manage their customer base that they had built up of people who were buying online or buying via email or calling them up. And it was a big change in their dynamics, and we'll see a little bit of that in this shortened version of my presentation. And just to note, this data is scrambled for this demo. That was the terms of the winery, so I don't end up revealing who they are accidentally. They were concerned about competitors realizing the same thing. So interesting, and I totally understand, but it is sort of interesting how that happens. So if we go to the next slide, slide 3, a lot of people have talked about customer segments, and I think it's been around for a while in my experience in marketing organizations that this idea of segmenting your customers and being able to talk to what different types of people who work with your company might want is totally logical. And in this winery, they had sort of these talking segments of, they called obviously a wine enthusiast, no surprise there. Also sort of the casual tourist who, maybe you have this in Australia and South Africa and other countries, we have these old busloads of people who will show up and visit wineries, and you have sort of these casual visitors, and wineries are always wondering, like, what's the value of those people? Is it just they're here, and should we charge them more money, or are they really important long-term to the health of the firm? And then on the bottom left, we have these sort of high rollers, and then finally the luxury, or I tend to call them blue blood estate, but they knew they had these niche audiences, but they hadn't yet really in their database identified who these people really were. And that was a bit of an issue of loss of information. I think that was very valuable in their marketing effort because a lot of their marketing is email and direct mail. And they said, gee, we sort of know who these people are, but we have this bigger and bigger database that's growing like by leaps and bounds in the last few years. We really probably would benefit by getting better messaging to the right people. And you don't really ask someone, hey, are you wealthy when you sign up for our winery? Or do you ask them if you're wealthy and you're flashy or wealthy and more conservative? So this is the first step we did, is try to come up with some rules and attempt to identify these people in the database based on their activity and some other data they had purchased about their customers.
Cool. So that's the idea of not, because you obviously can't ask questions of customers. Some questions are offensive, some of them they'll misinterpret, and you just don't get the opportunity to ask them. So by looking at their behavior is a way to get a sense of their segmentation.
Oh, yeah, and it's brilliant because it's very valuable in knowing, like, oh, gee, we had this big spending campaign on a local brochure, or we had this big write-up in Wine Enthusiast. I mean, what kind of audience came in the next month or two that was sort of driven by that traffic, and were they really more of the quote high roller, which, believe me, there are some differences in these groups, or more of a wine enthusiast? You know, it's called Wine Enthusiast. That doesn't mean it's wine enthusiasts who come in because of it. So it's sort of, it's a fascinating approach, and other businesses I've worked with have benefited greatly from identifying which channels are delivering which types of customers. So that was step one, was helping them identify in their database and estimate each customer, are they in one of these four categories? Well, we assign them to one of the four as our best estimate.
Tremendous. Great.
So when we did this first step, here's an example of one of the simple graphs that they wanted to look at and sort of understand.
On slide 4, everybody.
You know, slide 4, I apologize. Slide 4. They wanted to understand the relationship of these different segments and their behavior in the tasting room. And again, these are people who actually sign up in some way for future correspondence. They're not just everyone who walks into the tasting room. And they said, based on what the average spend is in the tasting room, and you can see on the x-axis here, the horizontal axis, that the groups do spend very different amounts in the tasting room on an average visit. And the question was, gee, beyond the tasting room, how much money do they spend in a 1 to 2 year window? And that's what you're seeing there on the y-axis. So it's sort of interesting. If we look at the wine enthusiasts, they spend about $200 in the tasting room and about four times more later. Whereas I look at the luxury estate, the little blue dot there, they spend less while in the tasting room, but far more in the next year or two. So they have a different behavior pattern. They aren't spending as much there. They want it shipped back to their home. And the wine enthusiast is doing more of a balancing act between spending in the tasting room and shipping. And a big surprise to them was these high rollers who spend a lot of money when they come in, and they tend to want the private tasting, and they want to meet the winemaker. They spend far more later than they expected. They thought they were very much spending there, and that was it. So this is sort of very powerful change to their thinking. And then finally, what they were concerned about, the casual visitor in the bottom left there, they weren't spending as much. They sort of knew that, but they weren't spending as much later, and they were spending the least while they visited, which they already did know that. So this is an interesting graph that starts giving you some insights that are very different than what they expected. A few of these observations were very different than expected.
It's so simple, though, Stephen. I mean, to look at you using two metrics there. One is their tasting room spend, and the other is how much they spend beyond that. And in such a simple graph, it just highlights so clearly the massively different pattern of behavior amongst each of those segments. So I love that when simplicity can be so revealing.
And I love that about Tableau, and also you're exactly right. If you identify powerful metrics that maybe go a little bit beyond what you've typically thought of, and you can use the power of your database, and hopefully you have some type of data mart or data warehouse or something that's well managed and that's managed toward these types of questions instead of just, we dumped all the data in there, isn't that great? That's like very empowering. And again, with a smaller company, it's much easier to achieve that. And so this is very exciting to them to see the segments and their different behaviors beyond the tasting room. And as you might imagine, that might affect how they market to these people and how much they'll spend marketing to these people.
It absolutely would, wouldn't it? And the different messages that they might even send to these people in their marketing.
Exactly. So if we go to slide 5, so this is the second aspect of this work that we did with this winery. We actually looked at lifetime valuation, and I know, personally, when I first worked with marketing organizations, after years as a statistician and sort of business intelligence expert, I was very surprised at how heavily focused marketing people tend to be on what I called a single purchase view. Well, we did something, and did you come spend money? And I think they've been limited to that view of the world by a lot of things. And I think in the last 5 or 7 years, things are beginning to change where we can look at how you behave over a long period of time. And more powerful than that, we can estimate with new customers what they will likely spend based on their behaviors initially. And over time, we'll refine for each individual customer that valuation based on their future behaviors. So it's a very radically different way of thinking of, you know, I spent $3 on Google to get someone to click on this page, but are they worth $30 in the next 3 years, or were they worth $3 in the next 3 years? I mean, that's a very different, like, outcome. So it's taking a longer-term perspective. The hard part here is you have to have some type of modeling, you know, data mining. Shouldn't scare you. If you have good data, you can start doing this kind of work. And it's extremely amazing how that might change your perspective of certain channels and how effective they really are. Of course, this could be scary if you have a larger marketing organization where some groups might lose power and others might gain power. But, you know, I think in net, when you talk to the marketing organization, everyone wants to see marketing become more effective. It helps marketing become more important to the company and deliver better value.
It needs to go that way. I mean, there's already been a well-established culture of measuring and tracking in direct marketing, but in more general marketing, sort of branding and that kind of thing, people have always shirked the idea of being able to measure the impact that they have. But it's just so important. Any money we spend to whether it's to attract customers because we want to grow our profit, or whether it's to influence a community or whatever, our marketing spend really does need to be somehow linked to the benefit or the value that brings into the business and the bottom line.
I totally agree, Stacey. And I think What's fascinating is when I look at something like Google Analytics or Omnitour and how people can track data on the web, and it's made a lot of marketing people excited, and I think justifiably so, I still get a little bit frustrated when I look at that and I see it still misses this dimension of lifetime valuation. And I've worked with Google data and Yahoo data and other firms' data sources, and it is fascinating that none of them really help you easily get to this lifetime valuation metric, and there's a lot of reasons they can't easily do it. But as a marketing organization, you really want to say, we want to spend more money getting extremely valuable customers, and a single purchase doesn't necessarily tell us that information. We have additional data we can use based on prior customer behavior to get better ideas of how valuable these new customers are and likely will be. And you want to make sure you invest for the future, not just for the tactical.
Definitely, absolutely. Because, I mean, there's no end of stories about people who have attracted customers, looked like they were making some great profit, or at least they were looking at revenue in the short term, and it ended up being that customers were costing them more than the value they were getting from them, just through that relationship management cost and discounting and all sorts of things. So yeah, the lifetime view is very important. I think I covered that in a recent Show Me the Measures webcast too. So for those Gold members, if you're interested in learning a bit more about customer lifetime value, you can go back and listen to the Measures for Customer Relationships, I think it's called. That's in our online forum. Everyone else, just Google customer lifetime value. You will find loads of information about it on the web. But back to you, Stephen. Sorry about that.
Excellent. No, thank you. Well, and actually, we're writing a white paper with Tableau right now, Eileen and I, my partner, my wife as well, on lifetime valuation and customer segmentation with Tableau. So it'll be a further sort of expounding on what we're discussing here. That'll be out in the next month or two, hopefully. If you go to slide six, so this is where we get into more, I guess, well, frankly, amazing. It's not so amazing to me because I've been using Tableau for a while, but amazing visualizations that you can do. So what we're looking at here is on top, we're looking at this single view. We have average discount on the x-axis, and that's from 0 to 40%. And then on the y-axis, we have sales. And that axis is a logarithmic axis, and that's sales over the past calendar year approximately. Fiscal year. And what we're just visualizing here is, as people have a higher average discount across their transactions, are they spending more? And you can sort of see this cluster here on the single graph that's all in purple in the middle there. You can see this big clustering that sort of extends out to about 25%. And you can sort of see on the top some people who have spent significant amounts, like $5,000, $10,000 in the last year, and how much of the discount they have. So that's an interesting slide, and I can make some conclusions out of it. But if we go to the bottom four-panel slide, part of the slide, it's the exact same data, but by customer segment. And the part I haven't mentioned yet is the size of each point, the little plus sign, is indicative of how much we estimate their long-term value or lifetime value as a customer is. So we've actually got three metrics viewed here for about 10,000 customers in this sample. So we're looking at the casual visitor, and you can sort of see almost none of them spent over $1,000 over a one-year period. We can also see they have, you know, discounts going up to about 15, 20, 25%, some of them way out to 40%. Next group, if you look at the high roller group, surprisingly, you would think these people wouldn't care about a discount, but apparently they do ask for discounts. And you could ask, just looking at this one little visual, do they spend more with a bigger discount? And actually, the answer was surprisingly, it appears like yes. So even though they spend lots of money, they still somewhat respond to a discount. We go to the next group, the luxury estate. They look a little bit different. And we can sort of see here that they do seem to use discounts, but I wouldn't say discounts are critical. And then finally, go to the wine enthusiast. And I had some further research in my earlier presentation that's not all shown here, but the wine enthusiasts are very responsive to discounting. And it's sort of an interesting group of people that, you know, the company is obviously very concerned about keeping them happy because they spread good word about their winery, hopefully. But these people, I think, wait and buy the wine they want when it goes on sale. They know there's times of the year, and they have these whole big, I'm sure, cellar full of wine. So they buy at times of sale and when there's special offers made. And they're a bit fascinated by this, that the wine enthusiasts were the most responsive to discounting. Likewise, you can see the little plus sign. Some of the highest lifetime valuation people are also, we think, in this wine enthusiast area, as well as high rollers. So it's an interesting amount of information we can put in one single four-paned graph there.
That looks so pretty, too. I mean, that's engaging to look at. The color does something toward it, but the simplicity and just looking at the cloud of points and seeing the patterns differing between the four different customer segments, it's attractive to look at. It pulls your eye in, and the really cool thing is it's just so quick to get those insights that you just explained. It's wonderful. I love it.
Excellent. So any other thoughts, Stacey? I summarized a much longer presentation on my website for this first segment, and it's already out there. And like I said, there'll be a more detailed white paper we're putting out with Tableau this fall.
That'll be good. I don't think there's anything else that, well, there would be, but given time, it'd be great to go on to our next case study. So, Stephen, if people go to your blog, they'll be able to read more about this?
Excellent. Yes, they will. Thank you, Stacey.
Okay, good. So everyone, there is a link to freakalytics.com on the webcast page should you want to go and check out these case studies in more depth. So let's go on to our next one. And this is an interesting one because it's sort of not so much couched in the sense of how to make a company more profitable, but it's more about this idea of, well, maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but the idea of responsible journalism. We're going to look at, Stephen, you're going to take us through a case study about oil and gas reserves and showing how using analytics and more powerful visualization of metrics that we can get a really different perspective, I guess, on oil and gas reserves around the world. Tell us about that.
Thank you. No, that's a good summary, Stacey. And I think I've worked with journalists a long time ago when I was a professional photographer. And when I was very young, I worked with professional photographers. I worked with some newspapers, and I also worked at my school newspaper as an editorialist and columnist. But I've talked to a lot of journalists. I know a lot of them are very concerned with integrity and showing a fair picture. I think, unfortunately, many of them confess to me personally that they're not great at analytics, and so they tend to use readily available simple metrics that sometimes are good and sometimes are very misleading. And part of my point here is I see this also in companies. So this isn't just for journalists. If you think differently about your metrics and say, forget about what data we have, what actually would most inform us, and is there some way we can get to this better metric that would really inform the question at hand? I think it's interesting when you talk about petro wealth, which is oil and gas reserves, and the proven reserves that exist in countries. You often hear about Saudi Arabia. At least here in the U.S., we hear a lot about the North Sea and the reserves there, which seem very important to Europe. But I asked the question, just I said, well, I'm curious, if I think of wealth as a wealth per person in a country, as well as how is this regional concentration of wealth maybe different than people might expect? That was my simple question, just going in here and saying, what metrics are a little bit better and maybe still easily readily accessible, and how can we show that in a different way than I typically see in articles and things like the New York Times or Financial Times?
Fabulous. So, everyone, are we on slide 7, Stephen, or should everybody be moving now over to slide 8?
Sure. Let's go to slide 8, Stacey. If you look at slide 8, it's a very simple summary. Personally, I was a little bit blown away by the numbers of wealth reserves in oil and natural gas, and these are proven reserves. And I use that term proven loosely because there is a lot of jiggering that seems to go on in different countries of what is a proven reserve. But we'll ignore that for the moment and just say, where is all this petroleum wealth concentrated in the world? And this is pretty fascinating. So if I look at this, I see Middle East, not surprisingly, 55% of the world's petro wealth is concentrated there. Almost $70 trillion of wealth is concentrated still in the ground. 70 trillion. That's just a stunning number. Eurasia, which is Europe and part of Asia, 14%. North America, 9%, which is very interesting. I don't want to get into politics, but there's been a whole debate here in North America for a long time about, can we become energy independent? And when I look at this, 9% of the world's concentration, it's not a lot. Africa, 9%. That was a little bit surprising to me, I guess with Libya and a few other countries, but we'll see as we get further along. Central and South America, 6%, which isn't that much based on the U.S. media coverage of Venezuela. And then finally, Asia and Oceania and Europe, 2%, you know, very small amount of wealth there in terms of petro wealth. If we move to slide 9, my first question was, I'm just curious, if I look at populations of the world and then I look at the concentration of petroleum, look at how different these two panes of the graph are. Literally, Asia and Oceania is a massive amount of the world's population. It looks like over half just looking at this graph, and almost none of the oil wealth. Just the tiny little bar there. Look at Africa, next biggest. They actually have a reasonable amount of oil wealth, but they have a lot of other issues, unfortunately, in Africa, and hopefully it's getting more politically stable. Look at Europe, you know, very, very oil and gas poor, third biggest population in the world. And I can move on down, and I see Middle East is the smallest population of these regional groupings that were used in this presentation, yet by far the most wealth. So we're going to expect to see some very theoretically wealthy people in the Middle East due to the wealth of their country and those assets that their country presumably controls. So I just thought this was a stunning slide, just how different these two simple sorting of world population against oil and gas reserves.
Well, they're almost the inverse of one another. It is stunning, like you say. I look at that and I think there's some pattern there. That's the weirdest thing. It almost is the inverse. Incredible.
It is. It is. So if we move to slide 10, the next slide, this is almost like a Pareto chart. And I want to thank Stephen Few for taking a look at my presentation and giving me some nice feedback. And he actually suggested that I improve this graph to add the Pareto aspect, and I think it does add to it. So on top here, we have the cumulative wealth of the world in oil. And on the bottom is we have each individual country and how much proven reserve is in each country. What stands out here on that top part of the graph is four countries in the world control 50% of all oil and gas reserves, specifically Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, and Iraq. Now, I don't know about you, but I get a little bit nervous when I see Iran and Iraq. Even Russia, I mean, there's a lot of political instability in these countries, and Saudi Arabia is sort of in the middle of it, and they seem a little bit more stable politically, but you know, almost half of our oil and gas needs are coming out of just a few countries. If we move up the Pareto chart on top, the line chart there, we can see the top 10 countries in the world control 81% of all petro reserves. I just think that's stunning. It's a nice summary, and you can see we go on down the list, Kuwait, Qatar, UAE. Finally, we get to a country that's not in the Middle East or in Eurasia, Canada, Venezuela, Nigeria, Libya. And then finally, way over on the far right of the bottom is the rest of the world. Every other place in the world, it's maybe, well, it would be number 4 on this graph if I were to put it back over in this direct sort order. So I think this is also a fascinating way to summarize how much this wealth is concentrated in terms of power, as well as, we'll go a little bit further, in terms of wealth of individuals in these countries in theory. Your thoughts?
Amazing. It's really demonstrating the power of when we look for correlation or association. I mean, you're giving us the quantitative information, you know, a simple fact like the top four countries control 49% of the world's reserves, but you're also bringing in this description of the political element as well, you know, the instability in those, well, at least three of those top four countries. And it's adding another dimension to this, and the data is really coming to life, and we're hearing a story now through this. We're not just looking at a few graphs, and I think that's a very important thing. So for those of you who are listening, if you haven't picked that up yet, that's something I'd really love you to notice about our analyst rock star, Stephen McDaniel, because he's doing this. He's telling a story with the data that is rich in both quantitative information, but also adding in that element of qualitative as well. Keep going, Stephen. I'm riveted.
Excellent. Well, if we move to slide 11, this slide is going to actually show us that concentration on a per capita basis. So I was initially motivated by asking this question because I'd never seen this question answered, and I'm sure it's out there somewhere, but I hadn't seen it in the popular media. And I said, I'm curious if I use that population data, and then I combine that with the wealth, the Petra wealth data, what do I see on a per capita basis? And everyone hears about Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is wealthy on an absolute basis. They have a lot of oil there. They're number one in the world, but on a per capita basis, Qatar is worth almost $9 million per person, man, woman, child. That's just spectacular. I had no idea Qatar would be at the top of this list. So I can only imagine, I mean, even if they use 1% of their wealth per year, people are making $90,000 per person. You have family of four, that's $360,000 in theory. Now, where the money goes is a political question, but that's the concentration of wealth in that one country. Hopefully they can get credit easily, I'm assuming. If we go to Kuwait, even there, it's almost $3 million. UAE, $2 million. Then finally, Saudi Arabia is the first country below $1 million per person, per every living person. I was just stunned. And then I come on down here to the United States where I live, $10,000 per person of oil concentration. I'm like, boy, that seems like nothing. Politically in the U.S., why we would ever favor any kind of petro wealth kind of solution to our future energy needs would be absolutely beyond me when I look at how poor we are in these resources as a country. And but that's my personal opinion, but hopefully that's what this incites, is that kind of debate and questioning. And finally, we come down to the rest of the world and see the average country in the world has about $3,000 of oil and gas reserves per person. So I find it stunning, and I just find it fascinating as well.
It's like you promised at the beginning of this case study, is that it really, using different metrics, different measures to describe a situation, and how you combine that information together does give you a totally different point of view. And I love that idea of, you know, sometimes this kind of reporting is not about placing a judgment. Sometimes it's about stimulating a new dialogue, a new line of questioning, a new thing to debate or explore, which is probably data at its highest good.
And I personally think that's journalism at its highest good. It shouldn't necessarily give an opinion. I mean, maybe it does somewhat, but it should give you new facts that you didn't understand. And if you make it more facts-based as much as is possible, and there's two sides or three sides or 10 sides to every story, but I think it's a different way to, you know, make people think differently about the state of affairs and different areas of public life. So hopefully that's what this does. And I have to give some credit here. We've mentioned Stephen Few a few times, and he's wonderful. And his partner in publishing, Jonathan Kumi, I think has a wonderful book on this topic called Turning Numbers into Knowledge. And he is, I guess, the author of the first book I've seen that really was in this sort of concept of thinking differently about data and about calculating things. And I think Jonathan, I can't speak for him, but I'm guessing he would like this slide in particular, because it is sort of like, it's almost like per person, how much are these people worth? And what might that do to their political system in terms of how they might try to influence other countries? And also, you know, we can see all the fighting over the oil wealth, and we can sort of see why. I mean, Kuwait is such a tiny country to have so much wealth tied up in it, and you know, we saw it happen over the last 20 years around Kuwait.
Exactly. It's startling. Everybody, I want to mention that book again. I've just realized I've got it in my library here. So if you heard banging of doors, that was me shuffling into my bookcase to pull it out. Jonathan Kumi, and it's called Turning Numbers into Knowledge, Mastering the Art of Problem Solving. That's a good reminder for me to pick this up and start reading it again. Stephen, thank you.
Yes, and he's a friend as well, and he is a currently visiting professor at Yale, but a wonderful book on thinking differently about metrics, and so great. And so that sort of wraps up sort of the Petra Wealth review, and I just hope, I think if journalists have more opportunities, I think something you said earlier in the webcast, Stacey, you basically, without saying it,
Stephen, are you still there?
I'm sorry, my phone acted up. So you basically almost said it, that the tools had limited your ability to think of data in perhaps, you know, more useful and meaningful ways. And I think that's what's wonderful about a tool like Tableau is it is very intuitive and very powerful, and it was really built around this whole concept of exploring your data, and it really shows in how it behaves. I personally have been a director of research and development at software companies, and what they've done is very impressive because they did start from a different point than most software tools, and it really shows, and hopefully people like even journalists who are a little bit math scared might be able to do some more interesting and intriguing things much quicker and easier. So
I can vouch for that. I definitely found it. I mean, I haven't used statistical software for probably a decade or more. I used to use SAS, but using Tableau, it's all just point and click and drag and drop. It's just incredibly easy. I mean, you just, and I think we talked about this in our chat preparing for today's webcast, Stephen, is that you just don't need those detailed statistical skills to take advantage of this kind of analysis because the software is doing so much of it for you. You do need some appreciation. You need to be able to think in terms of statistical thinking, but to know all of the mathematics behind it is just not that necessary these days. So, tools like Tableau are easy.
And it's wonderful, Stacey, and I think what's happening, and I talked about it a little bit earlier, is closing the gap between, I call it advanced analytics, and the subject matter experts who really know their business, or they know their organization, or they know their field of research. And, you know, that middle ground is sort of where Tableau is falling, but I feel concerned for each group needs to learn new skills as this sort of closes the gap. The advanced analytical people, like you said, need to learn sort of storytelling skills, and they need to learn to talk more to the subject matter experts and think like them strategically. And the subject matter experts still have a few skills to pick up, even to use a tool like Tableau, but it really it makes it very amenable to learning those skills very quickly. And it's a very exciting field that we're in right now, so I'm very excited that I've chosen this field, and it's been really fun, and I see a great future for this kind of work. So if we move on to the final slide in this PetroWorld presentation, slide 12. So literally, this is the last thing I'll say about Tableau. Well, maybe not, but I clicked a button, did a little bit of work, and like a few seconds later, I have this nice map of the world showing that concentration of wealth. That's something that the whole idea of mapping data, there's some advanced tools that are wonderful at it. There's Google Maps, which I've had personally not that great of experience with mapping actual data. I do use it for some other purposes, but Tableau has wonderful mapping capabilities. And here you can just sort of see that concentration again, in the Middle East. And you can also see visually, like, I was a little surprised at some of the countries in Central Africa. There you see Venezuela, a country off the coast of Africa. If I was live in Tableau, I would hover over these points and see the names of the countries. I could drill into some details. But it's a really nice way to think of it on a traditional kind of map and not just in graphs. So it's like a map graph is what I'd call it.
They're really very powerful for picking. Well, clearly you can see the patterns, and obviously with the way you can map data onto some kind of geographical map, in this case a map of the whole world, the way you can add a few different metrics in there. Like I'm seeing at least two metrics at play. One that's giving you the color of the dot or the circle, and the other that's giving you the diameter or the size of the circle. So that's another important thing too, I guess, is how you can build in. You don't have to just look at one single metric when you're using this. There are very simple and beautiful tools that help you bring two, maybe even three metrics together.
And exactly. And what's wonderful is if I had data, say, more at the state or a regional level within each country, I could actually easily just change this view almost instantly to a much more detailed type of view. And that's just fascinating to me that I can visualize it that way. And maybe I see in the U.S. concentrations in a few states, and maybe in Russia it's in a few areas of Russia, et cetera. But and just to briefly correct something you said, Stacey, here I actually double encoded, or I showed the exact same information as the diameter and as the color coding to sort of emphasize and make it very easy to see those highest concentrations of wealth per person.
Oh, it is too. I should have looked at the legend. There you go. But to put a couple of metrics in there. Like you could have used color to mean one metric and the diameter to mean another.
Exactly, we could have, but here I double encoded or use the exact same data for both size and color to make it extremely clear, hopefully.
Which is a good technique, and I hadn't even thought about doing that, but certainly adds more power, more punch to the data. I don't doubt for a second that you would have come across Hans Rosling and his wonderful data visualizations on TED. So I just want to remind everybody else out there, I've mentioned Hans Rosling before, but he adds another dimension to his graphics too, which is motion, and that really brings things like maps and other kinds of graphs to life as well. So if you Google Hans Rosling, you'll find probably some TED videos that you can watch of him. He's very spectacular. Stephen, am I right in assuming that you've come across Hans before?
Oh yes, I've seen him several times, and he's a great example of analytic storytelling. And I will say that Tableau has that exact same feature where I could visualize this data over time, where it could like happen over the last 40 years. And yeah, you could definitely. That's another beautiful thing about Tableau is I can do that kind of visual push a play button and watch the data change over time or over some other aspect of my data.
It's amazing. So instead of time just being on the x-axis, like we're used to seeing our metrics, time can become movement, and you can see time unfold through time as you're watching a graph. It's so cool. I'm just going to get too carried away, Stephen. Please take us to our next and final case study, which is about how analytics can reveal strategies for maximizing the uptake in a community of green practices. And here in this case study, Stephen, you were you're going to talk to us about how you can bring together the community's views about green practices with the experts' views, and by merging that, help you get a stronger understanding of how you might be able to where the most leverage might be, I guess, for increasing the uptake of community
Certainly. Certainly. Well, first let me say this work was the work of my wife and partner, Eileen McDaniel, and she has a PhD in biology and ecology from UNC Chapel Hill, and she did this work after her doctorate, sort of looking at how expert opinion about the environment might combine with actual survey data from consumers and try to see, well, basically her concern was, what people do might not be that useful to the environment. And likewise, there's this idea of the experts going, well, why aren't people doing these things? And she wanted to bring those two aspects together in a simple white paper and explain how maybe thinking differently about managing your local, regional, environmental programs could be better done by looking at these two aspects simultaneously. So she was also editor of my book, Rapid Graphs with Tableau, so she used Tableau also in this presentation, as well as some advanced statistical tools. So a few questions here. You know, how are consumers behaving in terms of environmental activities in their day-to-day life? Are they primarily doing things that just save them money? Are they primarily doing things that are simple and easy? Or are they really understanding and doing what's most beneficial to the environment? And likewise, you know, expert opinion, there's this whole issue of what experts think, and, you know, she was trying to gather from a group of experts, you know, there's some dissent, but it was fairly similar what the experts thought were the better activities people should focus on. So it was a very, very interesting approach. And some conclusions, if we go to slide 14, she said, you know, it was interesting when she put all this data together, she could see newcomer communities, people who are less used to being in these environmental programs. You might want to look at things that are obviously convenient and possibly economical for the consumer. And you probably want to use a lot of educational programs and, most importantly, incentives to actually change their behavior. You don't want a penalty system in these newer communities because it may sort of recoil and come back in your face. And she also found that combining this data that you probably want to avoid activities that are low in convenience early in the sort of environmental programs in a region, city, or state. If we go to the next slide, slide 15, what we can see here is here's the expert ranking of the economic benefit. So it's very, very interesting. She put these in three groups of high economic benefit and convenience, and moderate and low. So the expert ranking, you know, they said what really matters most. So things like using cold instead of warm water, using your appliances when they're full, not when they're half full, recycling, etc. If we go to the next slide, 16, then she said, well, let's look at the veteran communities, communities that are maybe more used to environmental programs. How can they continue to do more environmentally friendly activities in their community, and how should they be managed? And here it looks like to get sort of further along, you might have to have financial penalties for non-compliance, like after several offenses. And you might have to have incentives for less convenient activities. So in the newcomer communities, you might need incentives in general, whereas in the veteran communities or the more established environmental communities, you might need to give incentives for the least convenient activities to make them occur. If we move to the slide 17, this is the slide I personally found the most fascinating. We look at convenience to the consumer as color-coded, and blue is extremely convenient. And then if we look at the environmental benefit, these are grouped into three groupings, high, medium, and low. It's just fascinating that the expert said alternative transportation was number one. Unfortunately, it's the least convenient for consumers. It's in that lower group of convenience that can be difficult. Next, we come to recycling, which is very convenient and very important. So, again, you might want to penalize people who don't do that. Local and organic food, again, it's inconvenient. It may be hard for people to do. Experts say it's very important. And you can go on down this list, and it is sort of fascinating how you find this mixture and how important they are to the environment, which is high, moderate, and low, and then how easy these activities are for the consumer. And again, you might want to manage these activities differently. And it was very fascinating. I didn't show all the data here. It's in the paper on our website, but some of the other data points that Eileen found in her work of varying opinions of people saying, I'm an environmentalist, but their activities didn't show it, or people saying that they weren't, and yet they were extremely aggressive in their environmental activities. So it's sort of interesting how people might label themselves versus how their actions show where they might fall in this continuum. And I think it's a fascinating way of bringing together expert opinion and actual kind of real world of what people are doing, and maybe it might affect someone managing these communities and how they think of these activities and how they might incent or penalize people who don't perform them in their community as they get along their environmental programs.
There's two really important factors that I want to draw out from what you've just shared, Stephen. One is the idea that, you know, a community is not just a community. A community is segmented or contains segments just like a customer base might have. And to understand those segments in a community is really, really important because, as you illustrated with the, you know, incentive versus penalty kind of argument, it's not really an argument when you can understand, well, you know, penalties are appropriate in one segment of the community for one particular type of behavior, but incentives are more appropriate in a different segment of the community. So that first point about the segmentation is really, really important so that we don't just have one strategy that is trying to you know, be the hitting multiple birds with a single stone. And the second thing is the idea about bringing these different pieces of information together. The, you know, what is convenient to the community versus what is going to be most beneficial from the expert's point of view. What's going to be what we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck on, and finding where's the common ground, where's the overlap between those two things, the compromise that would be a really good place to start, and then let's worry about, you know, the differences. Later, let's first start where we know we've got reasonably good impact on the environment and reasonable convenience to the community. Focus on that, but then set aside some time to address where's the impact really high, but the convenience to the community is really low. How can we manage that? So targeting those strategies, using those two points, I think is just so powerful. I don't know that we do much of that.
It's a different way of thinking. I think it's just, like I said, I feel like a lot of the time, and when I've worked with a lot of companies, I've worked with a lot of wonderful companies, but sometimes I say step away from what you've normally done, step away from the data that you think you have, and ask the questions of what would really be useful, what would really help us better understand and really change our business for the better, or in this case, change the environment for the better. And so, you know, it's asking these novel questions and saying, is it possible? I mean, obviously you have to keep running your business, but I think you have to have some time where you think more strategically like this, and you can radically improve your business and how things run.
It's exciting. You know, radically improve your business, radically improve your government agency, whatever kind of, or your not-for-profit organization, whatever type of business or organization you're in, these principles apply. And it's about peeling back the layers of data and really getting to those insights that are actionable, that help you take specific action to start new debates, to try different strategies, to target your strategies better, to get a higher return on the money that you're spending. It's awesome. Stephen, before we go on to the next bit, I wanted to just give everybody a reminder about how to ask a question, just so that when we are ready, the questions will be there waiting for us. So everyone who's listening via webcast, you can submit your questions very easily just using the Q&A form that's on the webcast page. Just type it in there and hit submit, and it'll come on through to us. If you've joined by phone and you've got a question, you can raise your hand. All you've got to do is I don't mean that literally, everyone. I mean metaphorically. You press star 2, and that will raise your hand on the dashboard that I'm looking at here, and I'll know who to unmute to enable you to ask your question. Stephen, while everyone does get their questions ready, would you like to? Is there anything else about the community case study you'd like to share, or are you ready to tell us a bit more about the kinds of things that you get up to, the things you do, your training workshops? Tell us a bit more about Tableau, that sort of stuff.
Sure. While they bring their questions together, the last slide of this PDF presentation just talks about that we have public and on-site Tableau training that we offer. We're in several more cities this year, in London, currently we're in New York, we'll be in Washington, and Los Angeles in December. And we've been working with Tableau. We're a partner of Tableau Software, and we're very excited about that. And we work with clients on things like dashboards in particular, and dashboard design. And I like to call it strategic dashboards, because I think it's not just putting your data in a dashboard. It's asking the right questions that matter to your long-term strategy, and being able to do this fairly quickly and have some insights, both strategic and then how do you operationally manage and improve the business based on these decisions. So that's what we're about. Irene and I as a company, Freakalytics, and we're having a wonderful time meeting a lot of great people, and it's very exciting.
It is. I mean, like I said to everyone just before, I'm in love with Tableau. I'm going to say when rather than if, Stephen, when you bring your course out to Australia, I'll be there. I'll be right in the front row.
Oh, excellent.
Learning all this
excellent
stuff. I've managed to set up a really simple dashboard for my business, just tracking measures through time and doing a few sort of bar graphs, Pareto charts, really, to look at, like, where do my subscribers come from and where do my customers come from and things like that. It's very basic, and I know I'm going to need training to go to the next level, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So, everyone, make sure you go and visit Stephen on his website and to check out the blog and the training courses. As you can tell, he's very approachable, very easy to get along with, so I'm sure you'll love learning from him in more depth. Let's see now what questions have come through. We don't have any at this stage from the phone lines, so I'm going to go straight to webcast questions. Let's see now. We probably have touched on this one already, Stephen, but there's a question here that asks, apart from learning the software, do you need special skills in analytics, or is being a business analyst enough? Have you got some thoughts about that, Stephen?
That's a pretty broad question and an interesting question. I do think just learning the software isn't enough, which is why in our class we teach sort of the principles of data analysis, the principles of data presentation, the principles of visual data exploration and also the principles of dashboard design. So we teach the software as well as we teach the actual principles behind it. And we can't teach all of those, but we teach the basics in each of those areas. And I think there's a learning curve. I think the learning curve is, like I said, thinking differently, looking at books by some ones we've talked about, Stephen Few, Jonathan Kumi. You know, the work you're doing, I think, is wonderful as well, Stacey, the idea of what are the right metrics? How are you capturing those metrics? Are they part of your strategic decisions? So I really think it's a combination, but definitely a tool like Tableau can radically change the percentage of time you're spending in analyzing versus understanding the data. And I think that's the most impressive thing about it, is how quickly you can sort of move and change what you're viewing, sort of, as a friend of mine called it, at the speed of thought. So analyzing at the speed of thought is just really impressive.
I love that expression, analyzing at the speed of thought. It actually probably relates to the next question that we're coming through here on the webcast, Stephen. It's from Peter in Brisbane. And Peter's asking, how do you work out what is the best way to display certain data? Do you use trial and error or just keep adding features to a graph to gain more insight?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in my class I show some examples using various products, and then I show some examples with Tableau. And a wonderful thing about Tableau is it gets you, in my opinion, and I've done a lot of graphing over the years, often two-thirds of the way to where you probably should be. It has a brilliant set of rules built in that somewhat automate the graphing process based on the types of data you've selected and the number of metrics you've selected. It'll try to pick what it thinks might be the best way to display the information. And it tends to follow a lot of Stephen Few's principles of good design. And I know they were inspired by Stephen Few's work at Tableau and some of their development efforts, and they're good friends with him as well. So I think that's just a good start. But I do think you have to ask, most importantly when you make a graph, what is the story I'm telling? So what story do I need to tell? It doesn't mean you're making up things. It means, how are you trying to explain the phenomenon or business aspect you're examining? What are you really trying to know? Like, what do you want to explain to your audience when you sit down and talk to them? And that should drive a lot of your graph design. Ideally, you want to simplify and make it as simple as possible, yet compelling and telling the story in multiple slides, potentially, as you sit down and explain it. So that's hopefully a good answer to that.
I would, if you don't mind, Stephen, add just a couple of things here. I think there are some basic, very basic principles when you are wanting to display different data. Like, and I noticed that Tableau does this did it automatically with my data, is wherever I had a metric where I was tracking it through time, it automatically gave me a line chart, which is exactly what I wanted. I didn't want a bar chart for that. When I'm looking at something through time, a line is the best way to see those patterns and trends and shifts and changes. When I'm using my data in a way to figure out what's happening the most, what's happening the least, what's the most dominant factor, and for example, it's, you know, of all the different places that people find me to sign up for my e-zine, my email newsletter Measure Up, where are they coming from, and which marketing strategy is sending the most subscribers, and that's a bar chart. I mean, that and Tableau automatically gave me that. So I think there are some basic rules to help you choose. Like, one thing I would say, Stephen, I don't know if you agree, but I never use pie charts. I think they're lame.
That's something Stephen Few became famous or infamous for, depending on your perspective. But, yes, I agree. I think, in general, pie charts don't tend to add much, and often they confuse and, unfortunately, hide the actual information you're trying to show people. And bar charts are almost always superior to them. And Tableau does have pie charts in it, but it's not a default feature. You have to actually turn that on. I think that was because so many people asked for it, so it's one of those popular demand things. But, exactly, I think bar charts are superior most of the time, and I feel like I'm on a religious quest there, but it is sort of true that they've been overused and the tools tended to favor them because they were flashy and kind of looking, and who doesn't like to eat pie, so.
Eating pie is good. I think a lot of people use them to decorate their annual report when they don't want their annual report to really communicate anything. It just looks pretty and looks like they're quantitative. So, Peter, I hope that that helps you. Stephen, I'm really tempted to ask one last question here, even though we're really running out of time, but have you got enough time to hang on the line for one more question?
Certainly.
Okay, and I don't even know what kind of response you might have to this, so, but it's worth asking because I know it's a really, really important topic for a lot of people. This question is another anonymous one, which is fine. How can you convince management that analytics is worth doing over and above the normal performance reporting that they're used to? So I might add a bit of context to this. I'm guessing that this person is saying, look, we do performance reports for our management team, and, yeah, we've got, you know, data in there on how different metrics are tracking. But how do we convince them to want to go to the next level of really doing that more in-depth analysis to look for insights to sort of bring different metrics together in the way that you showed us today, Stephen? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. I think case studies like some of these are good examples of, you know, gee, what if we could look at our data like this? What if we really knew that, you know, the likely worth of this customer? Yes, it's an estimate, but it's an estimate that we don't have that might shed insight on, you know, how we're spending our money. I would hope with companies like Netflix and Amazon and the features they've implemented, which are clearly driven by analytics, hopefully it makes it more compelling and clear how it might be done. I think what's scary to people is, you know, it does potentially radically change the business. And if people have sort of possession of certain parts of the marketing organization or management organization, it may feel like a threat. But, you know, I think the question is it going to be you or your competitor that first, you know, better uses the data they have on their customers and makes better decisions and hopefully makes them better offers to make them happier and more profitable customers at the same time. And I think I can't say it enough. When I worked at Netflix, they used analytics to improve customer service, to improve profitability, and to just improve how they worked as a company. And I think that type of thinking has to come from the top down ultimately, but I think the more you show case studies and the more you show examples of, don't we want to be a great company and not just a good company, that we want to really make the most out of the assets we have. And right now, as you can see with someone like Google, who's worth almost $200 billion, you know, they don't have that many physical assets. You know, they have data assets, and they're using them effectively. And if you look at how effectively they used it compared to, say, Yahoo, they're worth almost 10 times as much because they use their assets, in theory, better, and it really shows in their bottom line. If that doesn't convince management, then maybe a new company might be a better fit for that person.
That is so true. That is so true. But everybody, that's a really great tip is, you know, use case studies. And look, in the space of analytics, Stephen's mentioned several of them. There are many wonderful companies that have already paved the way and have shown the exact impact that analytics has had on their bottom line. So it's, you know, there's no shortage of case studies, that's for sure. Stephen, we might have to draw. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Can I say one more thing on that? I've seen a surprising amount of executives taking Tableau training, and that was a big surprise to me. And why they're taking it is because you said it earlier, it's visually appealing. It's analytics made appealing, and it's sort of demystifying the idea of analytics. It's still not the same as data mining, although I can sort of do that. But I think by making it accessible and seeing data in a new light, it's opening up the opportunity for this people who want to do more advanced kind of work and better use their data to sort of show, like, if we do this, here's how we can see this, and we can see things changing, and we can see how we're doing these new programs, and we're going to spend more money or less money or change how we manage customers. And I think the visualization aspect is not to be undervalued as to how important it is to changing the organization and making them excited and willing to invest in those kind of projects instead of just, I can't really understand what you're doing. Well, if you show it to them, it really does, I think, drive the change much quicker.
That's it. They can see what's possible. It's, you know, that compelling vision. Wonderful. Well, thank you, Stephen. I think we will need to start wrapping things up right now. Oh, and I should say, you've already got 3 case studies now, everybody, to do exactly that from today's call. So make sure that you keep a copy of the PDF that Stephen has provided for you that we went through today. And there you go. You've got some brilliant examples straight away to start showing to your management and executives to whet their appetite for analytics. Well, thanks, everyone, for joining in today. Gold members, the audio recording will be available in our online Measures and More forum within the next day. Usually it's a lot quicker than that. Claire's pretty amazing at getting these things out to you. You'll also get my personal action notes that summarise the key learning points from today's webcast too. Silver members, you will have access to listen to the online replay of today's webcast and you'll be able to download it also, but only for the next 2 weeks. If you wish to download recordings of all our other Measures and More webcasts, you can upgrade to Gold membership. It's a mere $47 Australian a month, or you can buy an annual membership for $517, which gives you a month for free. And you can do that at measuresandmore.com. Upgrading will give you access to our private Gold online networking forum, where the archive of all the webcast recordings live, plus other great resources to support your performance measurement practice too. Remember, our next Measures and More event is our October case study webcast with yours truly, on the topic of carving out a KPI career, the skills, lessons and inspirations that made me a performance measure specialist. So make sure you pop this into your calendar. It's Tuesday, October 20, 9 a.m. Brisbane time. And you'll want to join me live for this one because I have a time-sensitive opportunity for those of you who have or do want performance measurement to be an integral skill in your career. Stephen, thank you so much again for joining us today and sharing a week in the life of an analyst rock star with us.
Well, thank you so much, Stacey. It was really enjoyable, and thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Everybody, this is where we're going to leave you. Thanks for joining. I'll catch you again in our next Measures and More Mastermind event with lots more great performance measurement resources. This is Stacey Barr, Performance Measure Specialist, signing off.